There, married a Russian woman. She still doesn't speak English. They have two children. And he has openly stated that he admires communism, although it is not explained why he returned from Russia, why the Russians apparently refused him citizenship after he had been there 2 years. But he's also an admirer of Fidel Castro of Cuba. And he joined the Cuba Fair Play Committee, one of the committees. As we've told you before, this committee was formed with $5,000 sent to the United Nations to the foreign minister of Cuba by Fidel Castro personally, and the money has been traced. There's no argument about it, and the bank accounts have all been cleared. Now the question comes is, why did this man join the Cuba Fair Play Committee? He has been quoted as saying that he's an admirer of Fidel Castro. Well, it so happens that on August the 21st of this year, he was quite willing to be interviewed at NBC-affiliated radio station WDSU in New Orleans. He was interviewed by four reporters on that station, and their purpose was to learn his philosophy, the reason why he admired Castro. And the first question they asked him, and from now on out, it's their interview except for the first question. What is the Cuba Fair Play Committee?
The Fair Play for Cuba Committee, as the name implies, is concerned primarily with Cuban-American relations.
How many people do you have in your committee here in New Orleans?
I cannot reveal that as secretary of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
Is it a secret society?
No, Mr. Butler, it is not. However, it is a standard operating procedure for a political organization consisting of a political minority to safeguard the names and the number of its members.
Well, the Republicans in the minority, I don't see them hiding their membership.
The Republicans are not a, the Republicans are a established political party representing a great many people. They represent no radical point of view. They do not have a very violent and sometimes emotional opposition as we do.
No, I see. Well, would you say then that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is not a communist front organization?
The Senate subcommittees who have occupied themselves with investigating the Fair Play for Cuba Committee have found that there is nothing to connect the two committees. We have been investigated from several points of view, that is, points of view of taxes, allegiance, aversion, and so forth. The findings have been, as I say, absolutely zero.
Now, let me ask you a second question. Who is the secretary of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the national secretary?
Well, we have a national director who is Mr. V.T. Lee, who has recently returned from Cuba. And because of the fact that the United States government has imposed restrictions on travelers to Cuba, he is now under indictment for his traveling to Cuba. This, however, is very convenient for rightist organizations to drag out this or that literature purporting to show a fact which has not been established in law. I have said that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee has definitely been investigated. That is very true. Mm-hmm. I have also said that the total result of that investigation was zero. That is, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is not now on the Attorney General's subversive list. Any other material you may have is superfluous.
Mr. Oswald, if I may break in a moment. I believe it was mentioned that you at one time asked to renounce your American citizenship and become a citizen of the Soviet Union. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think that has a particular import to this discussion. We are discussing the Cuban-American relationship.
Well, I think it has a bearing to this extent, Mr. Oswald. You say, apparently, that Cuba is not dominated by Russia, and yet you apparently, by your own past actions, have shown that you have an affinity for Russia and perhaps communism, although I don't know that you admit that you either are a communist or have been. Could you straighten out that point? Are you or have you been a communist?
Well, I had answered that prior to this program on another radio program.
Are you a Marxist?
Yes, I am a Marxist.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is primarily the difference between a country like Ghana, Vienna, Yugoslavia, China, or Russia. Very, very great differences. Differences which we appreciate by giving aid, let's say, to Yugoslavia in the sum of $100 million or so dollars per year.
What's the difference?
The difference is, as I said, a very great difference. Many parties, many countries are based on Marxism. Many countries, such as Great Britain, display very socialistic aspects and characteristics. I might point to the socialized medicine of Britain.
Now, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long, drawn-out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers, and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just 1 second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date and had said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, it seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. The person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16, 1959?
As I've already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left. It's getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. It's very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner, to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the days that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy, getting this permission.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government towards Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly towards the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when he, in his last speech of July 26th of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regards to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comments and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
Now, there's the interview by four reporters of station WDSU in New Orleans with Lee Oswald on August the 10th of Washington at the Naval Hospital. Reports under date of Monday morning. We've already received such reports from Tokyo, and now we're beginning to get them from Europe because the clock has turned past midnight. And from Berlin, this touching report from the western section of Berlin. Some 25,000 West Berliners, perhaps more, took part in a midnight torch procession in memory of President Kennedy. They marched to the City Hall, where Mayor Willy Brandt was to speak to them later. The march was called by student organizations, but people of all ages and all groups turned out. Many of them wore black armbands of mourning. Some people in the City Hall crowd carried a large white banner with this inscription: President Kennedy is dead. He will continue to live in our hearts. His words were, "I am a Berliner." The outpouring of reaction from all over the world is truly remarkable. General Francisco Franco, one we hadn't heard of before now, or hadn't heard from, broke off a cabinet meeting when he heard of the news and issued a statement expressing his sorrow. Yugoslav's President Tito telephoned the U.S. Chargé in Belgium.
Masterminded by Satan, I'm sure, to do this terrible thing.
This is Bob Taylor at WLOS. Police are of the continued belief in Dallas.
We have no word from federal. Not only as a head of state, but also personally. It's a tragic loss for the whole Western world. And Paul-Henri Spaak, another Dutchman who has been a friend of the United States, a cosmopolitan Westerner, if we may so dub him, refused to say anything at all. "What can I say," he said. "It is awful news." And the Swedish Prime Minister, perhaps we haven't relayed his message to you yet, Tage Erlander, he made a radio speech tonight to his people about the president's death. And he called it a terrible disaster, not only for the American people, but for all of us who believe in the ideals he fought for and gave his life for. This from a neutral country that doesn't belong to the North Atlantic Alliance. And now, for those further details concerning a very tragically busy Washington, we take you to an old veteran, pardon me, a young veteran, Ray Shearer at the White House.
Morgan, we have just heard word that the body of President Kennedy is now on its way here to the White House. It will be taken to the East Room. It will lie in repose there from 10 o'clock tomorrow until 6 o'clock tomorrow. And then it will lie in state in the rotunda of the Capitol on Sunday and Monday. As you know, it was taken from the airplane to the Walter Reed Army Hospital. It was then prepared for burial and is now on its way back here. The president's immediate family will be present tomorrow from 10 to 11 in the East Room. Members of the cabinet, members of the executive branch, and close personal friends will arrive at the East Room from 11 to 2 in the afternoon. Justices of the Supreme Court will arrive from 2 to 2:30. From 2:30 to 5 tomorrow, members of the Senate, the House of Representatives, and governors are scheduled to arrive at the East Room. Members of the diplomatic corps will follow between 5 and 6. On Sunday, the president's body will be moved from the White House in an official cortege to the rotunda of the Capitol at 1 o'clock. And there it will lie in state until 9 p.m. Monday night, and then again from 9 to 10 on Monday. There is no word here on the funeral arrangements, but on the burial arrangements, but we are told that the family plot is in Boston, and that is the most likely place. That's the news at the White House. Ray Scherer, NBC News, at the White House.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, if I may, a hard lead wrap-up to refresh our minds on the main factors of this tragic, important, historic event. From Dallas, Texas, a hidden gunman assassinated President Kennedy with a high-powered rifle today. Three shots reverberated. Blood sprang from the president's face. He fell face downward in the back seat of his car. His wife clutched his head and tried to lift it. She cried, "Oh, no." Half an hour later, John F. Kennedy was dead, and the United States had a new president, Lyndon B. Johnson. Within the hour in Dallas, the police had arrested a 24-year-old man after a Dallas policeman had been killed. Homicide Captain Will Fritz says tonight witnesses had identified the man as the slayer of the policeman, but the Dallas detective said it has not been established that the man killed the president. No police authorities in Dallas will remark about the fingerprints, whether any were found on the rifle that did the slaying. The man under arrest is Harvey Lee Oswald, or Lee Harvey Oswald of Fort Worth. 4 years ago, he left the United States, applied for Russian citizenship. For reasons unknown to us, it was not granted. He returned to the United States with a Russian wife. They have two children. Oswald at first denied he had shot anybody. Later he admitted that he had owned the pistol that shot a policeman near a theater where he was arrested in the suburbs of Dallas. And in Washington, to complete briefly our wrap-up of the report, Lyndon B. Johnson assumed the burdens of the presidency tonight and immediately won a pledge of bipartisan cooperation from congressional leaders in the dark days to follow President Kennedy's assassination. The new president took over with an appeal for the help of God and the American people. He held a mid-evening meeting with House and Senate leaders of both parties after conferring with several leading administrative officials. Mr. Johnson was only a few cars back when an assassin's bullet felled his predecessor in Dallas, Texas, in a motorcade. As we have reported to you earlier, the Mexican government has closed the entire border with the United States. It has been made clear informally to reporters in Mexico City that the purpose is to prevent the escape of anyone who may be a suspect in the assassination across that border, because such an escape would be an obvious attempt by an assassin. For more on that story, we take you now to Barry Simmons in San Diego for a report on the closing of the Mexican border.
Moments after the assassination of President Kennedy, the Mexican government ordered the long line of international borders separating the two countries closed. American authorities were at a loss to explain the border closing to traffic lines of tourists streaming into Baja California for the weekend. Mexican officials at Tijuana would only say that orders had been received from Mexico City and that street barricades would not be removed for at least 72 hours. As traffic snarled, tempers flared. Tensions eased when Mexican border officials permitted Americans to return to the United States and Mexicans working in the United States who could show proof of residence in nearby Tijuana were allowed to return to their homes. Tonight, the Red Cross has established an emergency care center in a schoolyard near the border, and police are working double duty in an effort to untangle the increasing traffic maze. Barry Simmons in San Diego.
In Mexico City, the authorities report absolutely no change in the situation. They're keeping that border closed until they know what happened about the death of the President of the United States.
The NBC Radio Network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1:05 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday, tomorrow, with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
The Detroit news stations, WWJ and WWJ-FM, Detroit.
There are two principles in this deep tragedy: the late President John Kennedy and the president who took the oath of office in Dallas, Texas late today, Lyndon Johnson. There are two other persons closer than any other citizen in the world or in the United States. They are, of course, Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy and Lady Bird Johnson, the wife of President Lyndon Johnson. It seems now many, many of us know about Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy. I would say that fewer of us know about Lady Bird Johnson, because she has not occupied as prominent a position in the Kennedy administration, even though she's been with her husband very often, all the way through everything. As a matter of fact, for 30 years, Lady Bird Johnson has been at her husband's side in Washington, packing his bags for campaign trips, standing with him on social receiving lines, taking notes for him in the shorthand she learned in college. Today, she was with Lyndon Johnson on the campaign trail in Dallas when that assassin's bullet killed President Kennedy and made her husband the 36th president of the United States. Mrs. Johnson was born in Claudia Alta, or was born Claudia Alta Taylor, her family name, on December the 22nd, 1912. No one has called her Claudia Alta since she was 2 years old. A nursemaid nicknamed her Lady Bird. As such, her initials conform to those of the rest of the family, L.B. Johnson. Their daughters are Linda Bird, 19, and Lucy Baines, 16. There's Lyndon B., of course, and the family's ranch at Johnson City, Texas, is the LBJ Ranch. The daughter of a wealthy Texas rancher, Thomas Jefferson Taylor, Mrs. Johnson studied journalism at the University of Texas, took enough education courses to qualify her as a second-grade teacher. She was prepared with shorthand, typing, business courses to go into work as a secretary if need be. One date with Johnson in 1934, she was 21 then and he was 26, changed all that. One date with Lyndon Johnson. Johnson asked her to marry him. Mrs. Johnson now recalls, or did some time ago, "I thought it was some kind of a joke," she said. But she married him 2 months later. Lyndon Johnson in those days was just starting out in politics as secretary to a Texas congressman. The political pace quickened, and for 24 years, Mrs. Johnson stumped Texas in her husband's races for the House and the Senate. Like many another politician's wife, she has readily admitted this. She has said, "I am not deeply informed on political issues." That is definitely an understatement. When the idea of Johnson for president came up at the 1956 convention 7 years ago, Mrs. Johnson said, "I regard the job with awe." Mrs. Johnson worries about her husband's health. There is the memory of his heart attack in 1955. And she says, very frequently, "I worry about Lyndon because, well, he simply works too hard and too long." As the wife of a vice president, Mrs. Johnson's role expanded far beyond the confines of Texas and Washington. She has toured the world, entertained a Russian astronaut, and occasionally she has pinch hit for Jacqueline Kennedy. Most people describe Mrs. Johnson as calm and unruffled. Yet often there's a hint of tension about her. With her husband's government role so heavy, Mrs. Johnson has had at times to serve as father and mother to their daughters. Linda's a sophomore at the University of Texas. Lucy attends the National Cathedral School for Girls in Washington. Last June the 28th, this year, word got out that Linda Bird was engaged to Ensign Bernard Rosenbach, a Texan. He was graduated from the Naval Academy in 1962. No wedding date has been set. A spokesman for Johnson's has said, since Linda Bird intends to finish college, there probably won't be a marriage right away. Mrs. Johnson flies regularly to Texas for a change of scene. She takes care of business interests as the head of the Austin Radio Television Station. And that's a station the Johnsons purchased many years ago as a hedge against the uncertainties of political employment. In March 1960, when Lyndon Johnson was seeking the presidential nomination, Mrs. Johnson was asked what she actually liked to do. She replied, "I'd just like to go home and live in Austin and have a regular, solid sort of a life. Lots of time for the children and go to church and participate in civic and cultural life of Austin." This, of course, now seems beyond the realm of possibility for some time to come, because Lyndon Baines Johnson, Baines it is, B-A-I-N-E-S, will be president of the United States at least until January 1965. President Kennedy had served a little over half of his term. The police of Dallas, Texas, to resume the spot reporting of the news. The police of Dallas, Texas, know exactly where the gunman who slew President Kennedy hid in ambush. They're questioning a suspect who was on the scene at that time. That's the word. Lee Harvey Oswald is the man, the same man they've got under arrest right now in Dallas Police Headquarters. Captain Will Fritz of the Dallas Police Homicide Department says it has been established that Oswald had been in the building from which the shots were fired at the president at the time they were fired. This man, as we've previously learned, had worked in this building. It was a warehouse, a storage point for school textbooks. And it was unoccupied at the time. It was undergoing some sort of repair or refurbishing or extension. And Oswald got himself a job in that warehouse. And his supervisor, whom he's been working with for some days or weeks, his supervisor told the police that at noon, Oswald was in the building. Now it has been established by others that Oswald was not only in the building at noon when his supervisor saw him, but he was in the building at 12:30 when the president was shot. And now we've established that the shots came from the fifth floor, not the sixth floor. It's a six-story building, all right. The shots were fired from a 45-degree angle. The assassin was 100 yards from the president. His view was unobstructed. He used that 30-caliber rifle with telescopic sights. Now, there's been some doubt about that. Some say a Mauser German rifle had been used to shoot the president. Now, we're informed it was a 30-caliber rifle with telescopic sights. It can be noted, I think, fairly, that Lee Harvey Oswald was a sharpshooter in the Marines. He had become a marksman. The police report they found the rifle that did the execution or the assassination. It was partly hidden behind some books. It's a bolt-action model believed to be of Italian make. Now, that's a 30-caliber rifle of Italian make. Also found were three spent cartridges, as we've reported before, and again, repeating our previous reports, there were scraps of fried chicken around. It looked as if Oswald had been in the building for some time. The indication is that whoever shot President Kennedy sat for a long time, calmly fed himself on chicken as he waited for the exact moment to shoot at the President of the United States near an underpass on a road leading from the center of Dallas toward the airport. Now, that theater where Oswald was arrested, you see, was some distance from the scene of the shooting. As a matter of fact, it's been established now by rechecking that the theater where the man was arrested is some 4 miles from the Triple Underpass where President Kennedy was shot. Just before 7 p.m. tonight, Captain Will Fritz, that's 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, said that Oswald had been identified from a police lineup as the man who shot Patrolman Tippett. Now, that's further confirmation that Oswald was the man who shot the patrolman near the theater. He said, the police captain said, that an eyewitness had made the identification, and Oswald himself has admitted that he owned the pistol that shot the policeman. But he said, I don't know what you're talking about, when they asked him about the assassination of the president. As Oswald was returned from the lineup in front of witnesses, a reporter shouted at him, "Did you kill the president?" Oswald replied in a loud voice, "No, I did not kill the president. I did not kill anyone." Well, he's already practically admitted he shot the policeman. The police now say that Oswald, who worked in that book depository building, had lived in Russia, married a Russian woman. November 1st, 1959, he applied for Russian citizenship. It was denied. Now, perhaps we can get further detail and catch up with the story, this tremendously dramatic, tragic story of Lee Harvey Oswald. We take you once again to Pierce Allman at station WFAA in Dallas.
Morgan, the latest report we have from City Hall is the fact that Lee Oswald will be charged before midnight tonight. This announcement came from the district attorney's office. He has not been charged as of this time with the assassination. He has definitely been charged with the murder of the patrolman. But this word is that he will be charged, and the charge will read roughly like this: that H. Lee Oswald did, willfully and with malice aforethought, kill one John F. Kennedy as a part of an international communist plot. That's all the information we have to this time, Morgan.
I'm sorry, folks. That's the first little catch we've had in our transmission. We should pay tribute to our engineers tonight. These men have made infinite numbers of switches, and maybe that was somebody else's error. For the moment, I'll credit to the phone company, but it's been wonderful working with all of these men, with only one miss all night long. We were reporting about Oswald, and we now have Pierce Allman with a clear line. Pierce, you're there, aren't you still?
Yes, Morgan, right here.
There are several matters that are not quite cleared up down there, as you know. Now, as a part of an international communist plot, can you give us any direction or thoughts? We now have it that the Mexican government has definitely closed the border, indicating that they've been in communication with our federal security officials, indicating also that they themselves suspect some kind of an international plot. We note that from Havana, the Cuban radio waited for a very long time before they reported the original bulletin that President Kennedy had been shot and killed. Now, I'm wondering if we are justified at this time in putting any twos and twos together. An international communist plot, won't the police give you any clue, or do they feel they must conceal everything?
I'm sorry, Morgan. I couldn't get your question. Evidently, we have a technical problem down here. Can you repeat it?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I hope the boys leave the line up now. I say, is there any possible indication of a connection between this international communist plot, the fact that the Havana radio was extremely late in coming aboard with a bulletin? Every other nation in the world came out immediately with a bulletin on this. Havana radio held this story for some hours before they gave it to the Cuban people, and now we have the government of Mexico, incidentally, the only government in the Western Hemisphere that has direct air connections with Cuba and has refused to pull them down. The Mexican government has closed its border with the United States, and officials there frankly state to us they've done it because they suspect that assassins of the president may be trying to get across the border into Mexico and escape that way. Now, do the police there give you any justification for suspecting that this is a very large plot, or whether or not it's a very small one, and that Lee Harvey...
As a matter of reference, Morgan, we have no positive word from the police department concerning the number involved or just why they used this particular wording. The charge will actually be filed by the county authorities here in Dallas, the district attorney's office. And we have been trying to, for some time, get in touch with the assistant district attorney, Bill Alexander, who will, I understand, do the charging. This wording came from our reporter, Vic Robertson, at City Hall. And as to the legalities, the formal charge, we don't have anything. They aren't saying anything yet, I would assume, until the man is definitely charged.
So then we're left to conclude without any doubt that the district attorney of Dallas believes there is a plot. A plot means more than one. So they must suspect very definitely that more than one person is involved in the assassination of the President of the United States, and certainly in the murder of the policeman. Is that about all you have there at this time?
That's it, Morgan. Right up to this moment, we'll be in touch.
We'll be back with WFAA and its very able staff later. And now we have a revised version of the capture of the suspect in the president's murder. The details of how Lee H. Oswald, or H. Lee Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, was apprehended. We now have it as a certainty, a police report. A patrolman J.D. Tippett, this is an informal police report, not one of their official documents. Patrolman J.D. Tippett of the Dallas Police Force stopped a man on the street about 4 miles from the scene of the assassination. Now, we know that the assassination was 4 miles from the theater where Oswald was captured. So that means he was very close to the theater when this happened. The man drew a gun and shot Tippett. Then he fled as neighbors notified the police. A few minutes later, the cashier of the Texas Theater, 5 blocks from where the patrolman had been killed, telephoned Dallas Police Headquarters that a man had run into the theater. His description matched that of Tippett's killer. Four policemen were dispatched to the theater. The movie was in progress, but only a dozen or so people were there. An usher led patrolman M.N. McDonald to where Oswald was sitting. The man jumped up and said, "This is it." That's Oswald said that. He pulled out a snub-nosed revolver and tried to shoot McDonald, but the gun misfired. The four officers all jumped on him. He fought wildly until they had handcuffed him and dragged him to a car. Previously, our reports were that two officers had jumped the man. Well, apparently they smothered him with four. Now, Oswald has confessed to the police that he owned the gun that shot Patrolman Tippett. So the 4 miles are yet to be accounted for, and we have the mystery of the plot. Was he alone? Were others with him? The Dallas District Attorney definitely suspects it's a widespread plot, and the Mexican government has shown that it joins the Dallas District Attorney in this suspicion. The commercial capital of the Eastern world, so far as the Western world is concerned at this time, is a place called Hong Kong, one that's filled with intrigue and also with refugees and with Western sympathizers, with not even a coastline separating the city from Red China. It is under British protection, as you know. There has been a definite reaction in Hong Kong. We take you now to Hong Kong, China, and Ian Stewart.
The people and governments of Asia reacted with shock and dismay to the news of the death of President Kennedy today. The news of the assassination broke as most of Asia slept, and telephones were soon waking heads of state in Asia's capital with the first reports, which many found hard to believe. Most leaders reacted immediately, like the governor of this British colony, Sir Robert Black, who cancelled all his public engagements and ordered the city to mourn the late president with its flags at half-mast. From communist China, there was no immediate reaction. But Peking, which has been as vituperative about the late president as his predecessors, is unlikely to be moved to reasonableness by the stunning event. This is Ian Stewart for NBC News, Hong Kong.
Thank you very much. From away across the Pacific. It is interesting to note the reaction of President Johnson to his new office. As you have been told, he maintained his offices in the Executive Office Building across the street from the White House. Formerly was State War and Navy. And he chose to meet the congressional leaders there. It's a familiar setting. And he's not happy exactly with his offices in the Congress because actually he is an executive officer. Congress has always been suspicious of the executive officer in their midst, not because of himself, but because of the fact that he has no powers in the Congress, and Congress is supreme in its own precincts. So the vice president had offices there, but he rarely visited those offices. I would like to note that when President Johnson left the airplane that brought him from Dallas to Washington, he was apparently, for him, very shy. He was diffident. His face was grim. And he acted as if he were out of place there. And he was hesitant as he left the airplane and as he approached the microphone that had been set up for him for his first statement to the American people. Slowly, almost in a meandering way, as if he were bemused, he made his way to the cluster of microphones that had been set up and his first public pronouncement. His wife, Lady Bird, stood by his side, and perhaps you'd like us to repeat his very brief statement at this time. President Lyndon Johnson's statement to the American people, his first statement. This is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be weighed. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy. I know the world shares the sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear. I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask for your help and God's. President Johnson had written that statement on his way from Dallas to Washington. Just before he wrote it, when he and Mrs. Kennedy and Mrs. Johnson were aboard the presidential plane, he had taken the oath of office from a woman federal judge. And he said, as soon, almost as soon, as the oath was taken, in order that there be no gap of awkwardness, he said, all right, let's get out of here to Washington. We've given you many, many statements by many organizations, people, world government leaders. I'd like at this time to give you three statements. One of them comes from the American Communist Party. The other one comes from the John Birch Society. And another one comes from a powerful labor leader in the United States. The communist statement says this: all true Americans, in tribute to your husband, incidentally, it was addressed to Mrs. Kennedy, will not only condemn this political murder, but will also rededicate themselves with greater strength to the struggle for the democratic character of our country. As you know, all communists, including American communists, use the word democratic in the exact opposite meaning that we have for it. They mean totalitarian government ruling in the name of democracy. The John Birch Society spoke through its founder, Robert Welch. Robert Welch sent a message to Mrs. Kennedy. It says this, we quote it: I wish to express our deep sorrow at so untimely a loss to our nation of its youngest elected president, and to convey our sincere and heartfelt sympathy in your overwhelming personal loss. Walter Reuther, the chairman of the auto workers, their president, had this comment, very brief: the civilized world has been shocked by this brutal and heinous crime. All those who yearn for peace have suffered a grievous loss in the death of this gallant champion of human freedom. Walter Reuther had urged his union and his parent union, the AFL-CIO, to a greater and faster transition, as he saw it, into total civil rights in the United States. The new president, Lyndon Johnson, faces a somber ritual tomorrow at 11 a.m., speaking for all the people of the United States, or rather, acting in their stead. He will view the body of the president as it lies in repose in the East Room of the White House. It's an interesting commentary that President Johnson's greatest political love, and the word the political isn't right, his greatest governmental love for the last, well, it's more than his term in office as vice president, it must be the last 4 to 6 years, has been the space age. He has made the most eloquent, the most dramatic statements about it. He has been colorful in describing the necessity for our march in space. He has been instrumental in persuading President Kennedy to stress our conquest of space at times when many had thought we were spending too much money in space. Now, what about the future? If this man was even more wedded to space exploration than President Kennedy. We take you now to Peter Hackis in Washington, our Pentagon correspondent.
The late President Kennedy's most vigorous advisor on outer space was a man named Lyndon Johnson. As head of the Space Council, he's been acutely aware of the tremendous possibilities the use of space can hold for mankind. In fact, I'm told President Johnson was always after Mr. Kennedy to go even faster in space than he did. It was Lyndon Johnson who in 1961 recommended the initiation of the moon program that led to the Kennedy speech of May 1961, in which he outlined the U.S. plan to land a man on the moon in this decade. Every time he could, President Johnson over the last 2 years has urged an expansion of the space program for both defensive security and for civilian benefits. He has said many times that the U.S. public will get back $2 or $3 for every dollar it invests in space. Many of his ideas on space were included in President Kennedy's speeches on that general theme. Senator Lyndon Johnson, as chairman of the Senate Preparedness Committee back in 1957, recommended, along with the rest of the committee members, that the U.S. move ahead rapidly to develop a million-pound thrust booster, which the Eisenhower administration later turned down. He was chairman of the Senate Space Committee. In the military field, he was a leading member of the Senate Armed Services Committee for several years, strongly anti-communist, constantly pushing for development of long-range ballistic missiles. He was also a champion of an improved Navy and an expanded Army. During the Cuba crisis, President Johnson sat in on all of the top-level military planning. He backed the Kennedy blockade plan, willing to risk nuclear war in that instance. Mr. Johnson is a strong admirer of Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, which has given rise to speculation that Mr. McNamara may continue to serve on in the new Johnson cabinet. President Johnson has called McNamara the nation's best Secretary of Defense and the strongest man in the Kennedy cabinet. He was the first cabinet member President Johnson talked with when he arrived back here in Washington today. He'll need him, what with the problems he'll face in the Pentagon. Wherever the Johnson foreign policy takes this country, his military policy is expected to go before. Peter Hackus, NBC News, Washington.
A little while ago, we told you that the student organizations in Berlin had organized a torchlight procession, a very slow processional in West Berlin, to show they paid tribute to the late President John Kennedy. Well, now it's morning. They called it a midnight torch procession because it would be underway at midnight. Now it's morning. First, there were a few thousand. Then there were 25,000. And by the time the procession reached the Berlin City Hall, more than 60,000 West Berliners stood in complete silence after midnight. The freedom bell tolled in mourning for the dead president. Mayor Willie Brandt called for a minute of silence as the bell chimed out in the rainy night. That freedom bell is a replica of our own Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and it's a gift by United States citizens to the people of West Berlin. Mayor Brandt addressed the crowd. His eyes were red, and his voice shook with emotion. It was obvious he had prepared nothing. He spoke from his heart. "Here above us on the balcony," he said, "President Kennedy stood last June and told us that he was one of us, that he was a Berliner. We regard his death as our own loss. America has lost its president, and a tortured mankind has lost a man of whom so many people believed that he would show the road towards a just peace and a better life in the world. Berlin now puts its confidence in President Lyndon B. Johnson. President Johnson came here," said Willie Brandt, "August 19, 1961, a few days after the Berlin Wall was built. In this hour of mourning, I greet President Johnson." The people stood in silence in the rainy night before they began to disband. And now, back on our side of the Atlantic, there are more details available on the preparations for marks of mourning for the president. And we take you now to the story of the American flag on the passing of a president. We take you to Robert Abernathy on nationwide arrangements for mourning. He's in Washington.
This afternoon, shortly after word of the president's death came in, Undersecretary of State George Ball ordered all federal government flags lowered to half-staff and kept there for 1 month until December 22nd. Mr. Ball was at that time the highest-ranking official of the executive branch in Washington. The Secretary of State was en route to Japan. There is, about other matters, much uncertainty. We don't know yet, for instance, about the schedule of the federal departments or of the Supreme Court, nor has there been any announcement of the plans of Congress. But at the airport this evening, waiting for the presidential plane to return with the body and the new president, I spoke with Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader in the Senate. He felt that so many members of Congress had known President Kennedy personally that Congress would probably recess to permit them to attend the funeral. After that, however, Senator Dirksen did not think Congress would go home early. He pointed out that there is business that must be done, appropriations bills, for instance, which must be passed.
He implied that Congress would stay in session as planned until December 20th. These are meager details so far, but they are representative. Washington is either mourning or planning those ceremonies of the next few days which will honor Mr. Kennedy and then lay his body to rest. It's really too soon for other arrangements. This word has just come in, Morgan, from the White House. President Johnson has just left his office to go to his home in Washington for the night. This is Robert Abernethy, NBC News in Washington.
Evidently, President Lyndon Johnson feels it would not be fitting. As a matter of fact, he would be personally more comfortable to go to his own home rather than to stay in the White House. He did the same thing in his office arrangements. He went to his own office in the old State War and Navy building to conduct the first business he had as President of the United States, a meeting with his cabinet, that part of it that's in the United States, and a meeting with our security officers, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and McGeorge Bundy, the late President Kennedy's assistant.
The NBC Radio Network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1:05 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday morning with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
The Detroit news stations, WWJ and WWJ-FM, Detroit.
You've just heard a few seconds ago that President Lyndon Johnson had left his office in the State War Navy building, the executive offices of the White House, they are now, to go home. We'd like to take you now to NBC's Nancy Dickerson at President Lyndon Johnson's home in Washington.
Here at President Lyndon Johnson's home in Spring Valley on the outside of Washington, there are crowds of neighbors, children, reporters, and policemen. The neighbors lined up outside keep asking, "Will the president come home here tonight?" There have been comments that in this wooded residential area, the security is very difficult. It would be difficult to guard the new president. But there is a high wall, a wooden wall, around his mansion called the Elms. The gate leading to the Johnson home is closed. At the gatehouse, there is a private phone which rings constantly. That phone was installed during the Cuban crisis when security guards were put on. Extra ones were added at that time, and that's the phone that is so busy tonight here at 4040 52nd Street in Washington. So far, one station wagon was admitted up the driveway. It was carrying a television set. Inside, there are already many TV sets. All the lights are burning brightly. Inside also is the new First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson. It was she who so eloquently put it when she said, "This whole tragedy, the whole thing, is like a nightmare. Somehow," she added, "we must find the strength to carry on." The President and Mrs. Johnson telephoned Mrs. Rose Kennedy en route here to Washington from the plane. They tried to comfort Mrs. Kennedy, but Mrs. Johnson broke down in sobs on the telephone conversation. Finally, Mrs. Johnson said, "We are fortunate to have had him. The nation is fortunate to have had him for so long." This is Nancy Dickerson, NBC News, at President Lyndon Johnson's home in Washington.
About 10 minutes ago, we broke off coverage of the arrest of Oswald, Lee H. Oswald, or H. Lee Oswald, whichever it is. The report was that the district attorney of Dallas had already charged the man with the murder of a Dallas policeman on his way to a theater to hide, as he thought, among the audience. And we have the report that before midnight, Dallas time, this man will be charged with the murder of the President of the United States in an international communist plot. We'll have details on that later, but the questioning of this man by the police and by federal authorities offers obviously the most potent possibility in the way of clues as to what went on, whether this was a one-man or a two-man or a hundred-man conspiracy. We take you now to Tom Pettit, NBC News in Dallas.
Dallas Police Chief J.E.
Curry says 24-year-old Lee Oswald now is being questioned about the killing of President Kennedy. Chief Curry says Oswald denies the murder, but says he is, quote, a very good suspect. When transported in front of cameras and reporters a few moments ago, the suspect, Oswald, shouted, "They're holding me because I was in the Soviet Union. The police won't let me have legal representation." Within the hour, Oswald has been charged with the murder of police officer J.D. Tippett, but according to police here now, he still steadfastly denies killing President Kennedy. The questioning at this hour continues. Tom Pettit, NBC News, at Dallas Police Headquarters.
We have a report from San Francisco. A few days ago, it was reported officially that the new ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., the liberal Republican, would return to Washington to report to President Kennedy either on Sunday or Monday of next week on the change in government there, on the takeover by the military leaders from the old Diem regime. Ambassador Lodge left Vietnam yesterday, and he arrived today in San Francisco on his way to report, as he thought at the time, to President Kennedy. NBC News, Dean Mill, our reporter in San Francisco, has been in touch. He reports that Ambassador Lodge says he will not submit a report he had prepared for President Kennedy to President Lyndon Johnson. Ambassador Lodge was scheduled to meet with the president in Washington on Sunday to turn over the report on conditions in South Vietnam following the recent revolution. Ambassador Lodge would give no further explanation other than to say he does not feel it would be appropriate to submit a report intended for President Kennedy to President Johnson. Ambassador Lodge was vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket in 1960. He was personally selected by President Kennedy for the troubleshooting diplomatic mission to South Vietnam. Mr. Lodge says, however, he will visit Washington over the weekend to confer with State Department officials, and he adds that he plans to return to South Vietnam on Monday. It is easily understandable that he would not wish to report voluntarily to President Johnson, that he would rather wish to wait because he is not a Johnson appointee. It might even be presumptuous on his part. I suppose some people might feel that if Ambassador Lodge intruded into the situation, personal and official, in Washington at this time, he would rather be thrusting himself forward in some way. The ambassador, while he's not exactly a modest man, is certainly a man who would observe the amenities under all occasions and would not intrude into the very busy schedule of President Johnson at this time, unless, of course, it were extremely necessary. In that case, he could report to the Secretary of State, who will be in Washington shortly after midnight. He's due in with five other cabinet members who diverted their plane on the way to Tokyo for a trade visit, diverted the plane to Honolulu. There it was refueled, and it will be in Washington about midnight. Now, perhaps the one angle in this story that we have neglected, because it was more or less a beginning and we have tried to keep you up with events, was a story of the early morning of the Kennedys in Dallas today. They arrived in San Antonio yesterday. They had several political meetings in San Antonio. The president made several speeches, and Dallas was his second stop on a intended five-city tour of Texas. Well, this morning, he got up very early because he had a breakfast date. Mrs. Kennedy did not join him immediately. At 8:45 a.m., the president walked bareheaded and without a coat through a misty rain. He went into a parking lot across the street from Fort Worth's Hotel Texas. He was in Fort Worth in the early morning hours. He spoke there to a cheering throng of Democrats. They were the Democrats who could not get tickets to see him at a breakfast appearance earlier and apologized, or later it is, because Mrs. Kennedy was not with him. He made a very smiling apology. He said, Mrs. Kennedy is organizing herself. He paused very briefly and says, it takes longer. He didn't add the superfluous, superfluous remark that it takes longer for women to get ready. At 9 a.m., the president and Mrs. Kennedy attended the breakfast in the Hotel Texas, sponsored by the Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce. Mrs. Kennedy walked in some minutes late, and her entrance brought tremendous applause from 2,500 guests. Both of them got presents at the Chamber of Commerce meeting in Fort Worth. Texas boots for both of them, and a Texas hat for the president. President Kennedy declined to put on the hat in public. He joked that he would wear it in the White House next Monday. He's been a shy man with a hat. In deference to hat manufacturers, he had on occasion worn a hat, but he didn't like it. At 10:35 a.m. this morning, the president and Mrs. Kennedy left the Texas Hotel by automobile for Carswell Air Force Base near Fort Worth. There, they were to board an airplane for a short flight to Texas. To Dallas. At 11:37 a.m., the presidential plane landed at Dallas's Love Field. Mrs. Kennedy emerged from the plane smiling. She shook hands with airport greeters. She carried that bouquet of red roses that clashed with her pink dress. Young men in the crowd shouted, "Hey, Jackie," and squeezed forward with a closer look. Several young girls were screaming over the president as he made his way through the crowd. There was no sign of any anti-Kennedy sentiment, nor was there at any time today in Dallas. The party left in a motorcade that was to take them over an 11-mile route, including downtown Dallas. At 12:30, the motorcade approached that triple underpass that feeds into Stemmons Expressway, and the tragedy occurred. President Johnson, we hear from Washington, has arrived at his home just outside of the city. We take you now to Dickerson, at President Johnson's home in Spring Valley, Washington.
President Lyndon Baines Johnson just arrived home at his estate here on the outskirts of Washington in the Spring Valley section. He was preceded by a motorcycle caravan. His entourage whipped up the hill leading to the Elms, which is the name of his estate. There were something like seven motorcycles that preceded him, several Secret Service men. The regular Secret Service car was right behind. You could see guns. This is something not normal.